Thank you very much, Brother Miller. Now, the 10 words are taken from Exodus 20, and that's not the extent or the length of my message today. Somebody's already asked me, will you restrict your message to just 10 words? I think sometimes to say to a preacher, would you like to have a word about this? And that's usually good for about 15, 20, or 30 minutes. I sincerely appreciate the opportunity of being with you. I think this is my 19th time to come to the School of Preaching. I've spoken on 18 of your lectureships, counting this one. And some years back, the school invited me to come over and spend an entire day in talking about religious journalism. But it's always been a pleasure to come, and I appreciate the invitation from Brother Meadows, from the school here, and from the fine congregation. It's good to see the school on the march. It's good to see the congregation growing and thriving, and I rejoice over that so very, very much. My wife Irene and I appreciate the opportunity of being here today. The study of this hour is indicated in the title, 10 Words. And it's a study of the Ten Commandments, or the Decalogue as we sometimes refer to it. These words, or these commandments, are found in Exodus the 20th chapter and Deuteronomy the 5th chapter. There is so much in the way of misunderstanding, misapprehension, misapplication in regard to the Ten Commandment law, not only in the religious world at large, but even more recently and more strangely among us. It hasn't been too unusual through the years to find denominational preachers like Billy Graham and others to contend that the Ten Commandment law has never been repealed, that we are still amenable to it today. And strangely enough, some of our own brethren have gotten on that bandwagon in recent years, and some of them have suggested, I can think of no sense in which the law of Moses has been abrogated, or that it is still in effect, or that God has never repealed or annulled or taken it out of the way. And that's strange because we, of all people, have done so much teaching in regard to the distinctiveness between that which came from Sinai and that which originated with Christ and Christianity beginning on the marvelous day of Pentecost. But yet that is happening among us today. I came across this little bit of information a number of years ago when I lived in Sharon, Tennessee. One of our members taught a denominational preacher, a Presbyterian minister, the difference between the law of Moses and the law of Christ. At the end of the study, he said something like this, I have been preaching for the Presbyterian Church for something like 35 or more years, and this is the very first time that I've ever recognized any difference between the law of Moses and the law of Christ. Well, he hadn't studied his Bible very clearly. He had not done what Paul enjoins all of us to do in 2 Timothy 2:15. Study, or take diligently these matters. Study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing or handling aright the word of truth. Now, when we fail to make a distinction between what Moses gave on Sinai or what was given to him on Mount Sinai and what came through Christ and Christianity, we have not rightly divided the word of truth. We have not handled it correctly. There are various names that are given to these Ten Commandments or to the Decalogue. And these laws of the Decalogue are found, as already indicated, in Exodus 20 and then in Deuteronomy the 5th chapter. And the 10 are, thou shalt have no other gods before me, thou shalt not make unto thee, make unto thee any graven image of any likeness that's in heaven above, the earth beneath, or that which is under the waters. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Thou shalt remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And thou shalt honor father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee. Thou shalt not commit murder. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness. And thou shalt not covet. In the last chapters of the book of Exodus and the opening chapters of the book of Deuteronomy, these are referred to as the Ten Commandments. And really, the Hebrew construction in some of these really is the 10 words. not meaning that they are just 10 words, no less and no more. For instance, sometimes the New Testament will talk about the Word, preach the Word. That doesn't mean just one term, but it's a reference to the entire teaching that is involved. Preaching the Word is preaching Christ and Him crucified. And the 10 words refer to the 10 commandments. It is referred to as a law and commandments. It is referred to as testimony. That was that which was to be placed into the Ark of the Covenant when they built it and placed it in the Holy of Holies a little bit later on in the book of Exodus. It is referred to as the words of the covenant or the tables of the covenant. In the New Testament, when the rich young ruler came to the Lord inquiring about what he must do in order to inherit eternal life, Jesus referred to him in the keeping of the commandments. And the young man said, which? And Jesus listed a number of those found in the Ten Commandment law. Paul, in Romans the 7th chapter, referred to the law of Moses and the Ten Commandments in particular simply as the law. He said he had not known lust except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. Oh, what part of the law said, thou shalt not covet? The very last one of the Decalogue are the Ten Commandments. Interestingly enough, the word Decalogue is not found either in our Old Testament or New Testament. According to the research that I did, its first usage was by one of the early church fathers, a man by the name of Clement of Alexandria. But I think it suggests a correct and a scriptural concept. Deca refers to the number 10, and the last part refers to words or a message. Hence the 10 words or the 10 messages or the 10 commandments. Now, giving a brief assessment or a brief appraisal of these, commandments number 1 and 2 deal with God and the worship and service of Him. Especially, thou shalt have no other gods before me, and thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. And the third one also deals in our responsibility, or Israel's responsibility toward God. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. And the fourth one, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. These four constituted the first major part of the Ten Commandment law. Supremacy toward God is set forth in these four commandments. The first two say, thou shalt not engage in idolatrous worship. The third one suggests that God's name is to be honored. It is to be deeply revered. People are not to speak of God lightly or flippantly. And certainly that is needed in our society today. Many people cannot carry on any kind of conversation without taking the name of God in vain. Now we have a wonderful language, the English tongue, and there are so many excellent words, wholesome words in which we can carry on decent conversations, and yet many people will not employ decent words and wholesome words. They have to drag the names of God and Christ down to the low level of profanity, taking the names of deity in vain. And this third one said to Israel, don't do that. And the fourth one was about the Sabbath day. Now the Sabbath day did not refer to the first day of the week. Sometimes people today talk about the Christian Sabbath. That's really the language of Ashdod. It's not the language of the Bible. The seventh day, or the Sabbath, referred to the last day of the week, not to the first day of the week. And they were to remember that day, keeping it holy. Contrary to the teaching of the Adventist movement, the Sabbath day was not made known and practiced by people in the book of Genesis. Moses had to give instructions to the Israelite people on how that day ought to be kept when they were in the wilderness. It was something that was given to the Israelite people. Now these constitute Israel's obligation, Israel's responsibility toward God. And the last six touch man's responsibility toward other people. I wondered from time to time, since there were two tables on which these laws were inscribed, if maybe the first four were written on one table and the last six on the other table. I don't know of any scripture that will answer that decisively for us. But the last six deal with their responsibility toward other people. One had to do with parental honor and parental submission. Honor father and mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Paul, no doubt, was riveted upon this when he made it a part of his teaching in Ephesians 6, beginning in verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. I've taught a little children's class and meeting work and local work for well over 40 years now. A lesson that I've taught to hundreds of boys and girls, five reasons why you ought to obey God. Number one, he commands it. Number two, Jesus practiced it, Luke 2 and 51. Number three, it is right. Number four, it will enable you to live a longer life. And number five, your parents deserve that from you as children. And this is exactly what God demanded of the Israelite people. Honor thy father and thy mother. Number six deals with murder, the taking of human life. Number seven deals with immorality. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Common in that day and very, very common in our day. In fact, many people do not even refer to it as adultery or fornication or immorality or a corrupt kind of lifestyle. They just simply refer to it now as a relationship, and a relationship that they find absolutely nothing wrong with. That's behind the modern concept of where men and women will not recognize the law of the land and what God says, and they just begin to live with each other without benefit of a marriage ceremony or without benefit of buying a license from the state wherein they are married. But God's law has always been, continues to be, thou shalt not commit adultery. And then we have thou shalt not steal, and thou shalt not bear false witness, and thou shalt not covet. These protected property. These protected a man's reputation against slander, railing speech, perjury in a courtroom, and the like. And then there's that greedy, grasping disposition listed under the heading of covetousness. And, of course, it is described as being idolatry by Paul in Ephesians 5 and Colossians, the third chapter. These people were told, thou shalt not covet. Now, Israel needed these people while they were in the... Israel needed these laws while they were in the wilderness. They needed these laws when they were situated in the land of Canaan. They needed these laws before they were taken into the two captivities and after they were released and brought back to the land. They needed these laws throughout the Mosaic dispensation. And we shudder to think what Israelite history might have read like if they had not had laws such as I have set before you, Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy, the fifth chapter. But another important part of our study deals with to whom were they given. Now, many people have the concept that they were given to the entire world. And yet, that's not what the lawgiver, that's not what the one who received them said about the matter. In the book of Deuteronomy, Moses gives a number of messages to the generation that is to soon pass over Jordan under the leadership of Joshua due to a sin and infraction on his part at the waters of Meribah, Numbers the 20th chapter. Moses was not going to be permitted to lead them across and to set his own feet on the coveted soil of Canaan. Joshua would do that. But Moses gave some tremendously great counsel and advice to the new generation soon to enter the land of Canaan. And these are found in the book of Deuteronomy, these messages that is. And among other things, in Deuteronomy the fifth chapter, before he enumerated or gave the 10 words of the 10 commandments, he said, the Lord our God made a covenant with us, even us, who are all of us here alive this day. God made that covenant with a nation of people. He made that covenant with the descendants of Abraham through Isaac through Jacob. He made that covenant with people who had lived in the land of tyranny, the land of Egypt. He made that covenant with people who had forsaken or abandoned that land through the help of God. He made that covenant with those who had passed through the Red Sea. He made that covenant with those who were at the very base of Sinai. Moses, of course, being the lawgiver, or on this occasion, the law receiver. Moses was in perfect position to know to whom that law was given. And it was not given to the world at large, because the world at large had not been in the land of Canaan. The land of Egypt. The world at large had not been protected by the blood-stained doorposts and lintels of their households. The world at large had not passed through the sea, being baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And of course, the world at large was not at the base of Sinai. God made this into a national covenant, into a covenant between himself and the Israelite people. Exodus, the 31st chapter, is not really the shortest chapter in the book, but it's among the shortest. And in that relatively short chapter, Moses gives instruction especially about the Sabbath day. And God said, the Sabbath day is a sign between me and Israel. That's what God said about the matter. Well, if that's true of the fourth commandment, it would be true with the three that precede it and the sixth that comes subsequent to it. The Sabbath day was not given just to Israel, with the rest given to the entire world. It was an entire covenant given to the Israelite people. And we do not have to be in the dark about what its purpose was. Its purpose was to prepare, pave the way, do a pioneering job for the ultimate coming of Christianity. Paul had a deep awareness of the difference between the law of Moses and the law of Christ as he wrote the various books of the New Testament, and he does some very clear teaching along this line in the book of Galatians. In fact, I would say that the key word or the key term of Galatians would be the difference between the law and the gospel. And in talking to the Galatian people, he said the law was our schoolmaster or tutor to bring us unto Christ. But after that Christ and Christianity have come, we are no longer under the schoolmaster. And so here's a law that was given to the Israelite people, not to the world at large. Well, another question of significance, has that law been abrogated? Now, Billy Graham does not think that it's been abrogated. Reuben Shelley does not think that it's been abrogated. He preached a sermon in Nashville almost 10 years ago in which he said, I can think of no sense in which the law of Moses has been abrogated. I understand that he's now trying to extricate himself from this difficulty by saying that by abrogate he meant that it wouldn't be shattered or destroyed. Well, he needs to look up what the word abrogate means. It means to annul or to remove or to take away. And the Bible says that he did abolish that law, Ephesians 2 and verse 15. He did not come to shatter or destroy the law of the prophets. He came to fulfill them or fill them full, and then it was his purpose to remove them in order to bring in his own better system. Billy Graham has been on record for many, many years in teaching that the Ten Commandment law has never been repealed. When I lived in Nashville, Tennessee, back in the 1950s, attending Lipscomb and a little bit later on Peabody, many of the denominational people in Nashville brought Mr. Graham to the city, and he conducted a crusade out at the Vanderbilt football stadium. Well, they had him housed in one of the downtown motels in Nashville, and it's a lot further from that motel out to Vanderbilt campus than just the fractional part of a Sabbath day travel mile. And he gave an interview while he was in Nashville in which he said the Ten Commandments have never been repealed. And yet he gave a message on Saturday out at the football stadium, meaning that he had to travel more than that fractional part of a mile. What about all the times that he's boarded a plane on Saturday morning and travel maybe hundreds of thousands of miles to begin a crusade the next Sunday night at a distant place, maybe even into a foreign country? And yet he contends that the Ten Commandment law has never been abrogated, that we are still amenable to it today. If so, that means that we are obligated to keep the Sabbath day law. How much of the Sabbath day law? All of the Sabbath day law. Meaning that a person could not strike up a fire in the fireplace on Saturday morning because they were forbidden to do that. Meaning that if a woman has a gas range upon which she cooks, that she could not cook the Sunday meal Saturday afternoon because she would have to turn on a flame of fire in order to cook the meal. They were forbidden to do that. And they were also forbidden to even pick up sticks on the Sabbath day. We have an example of a man over in Numbers, the 15th chapter, who was stoned because he picked up sticks on the Sabbath day. Oh, how many of us on Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon have done yard work, and usually there are a few twigs that need to be picked up before maybe the grass is cut, and we think nothing about doing that. We haven't violated any kind of law. But we would be violators of it if the Ten Commandment law is still in effect. When I lived in Mount Julia, Tennessee, close to Nashville, while there, the Adventist people came to the south part of the little village of Mount Julia. It was small then, quite a large city now. But they set up a tent. And on Saturday, they went all over the west part of Wilson County passing out their literature. I happened to be working in the yard that Saturday afternoon. They handed me some of their literature. I took it and read it a little bit later on. And all of their literature was to the effect that we ought to be observing the Sabbath day. I thought, how utterly inconsistent. They're operating from a base about 2 miles from my house, and they've traveled at least that distance to hand me this literature. And of course, they went on down the road even further away from the tent after they left my house. Well, they had violated their own teaching. And another thing, not only did the Old Testament have a Sabbath day, but it also had a Sabbath year. Every seventh year was to be a period when they allowed their land to lie idle. I wonder how many Sabbatarian farmers have practiced that part. I wonder how many times Graham and Shelley and others have told people who have gardens in the city that every seventh year you're not to plant any lettuce or radish. You're not to plant any carrots. You're not to plant any sweet corn because the land is to lie idle every Sabbath year. Well, that was part and parcel of the Old Testament law of Moses. Well, that law has been removed. In fact, Jeremiah said in Jeremiah 31:31-34, that the days are going to come when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Jeremiah knew that the Old Testament law was a temporary kind of system. And Jesus said, "Think not that I have come to destroy the law of the prophets. I have not come to destroy, but to fulfill." Not only that, but Paul teaches in Romans, the 7th chapter, that you have become dead to the law by the body of Christ. In 2 Corinthians, the 3rd chapter, he draws some clear lines of distinction between that which was written upon tables of stone, which was a system of condemnation, a reference to the Old Testament law, and then that system or the law of glory, that was a reference to the Christian religion. And he says that which belongs to the condemnation has been done away with. It has been abolished. And of course, we have the glories of Christianity continuing with us. In Romans, the 10th chapter, he told us that Jesus Christ is the very intent, the very purpose of the Old Testament law. Paul, in Ephesians, the 2nd chapter, says that Jesus Christ has broken down the middle wall of partition between us. That middle wall of partition was the law that separated the Jew from the Gentile. Paul said it's been broken down. Graham says it hasn't been broken down. Shelley says it hasn't been broken down. Steve Flatt says it has not been broken down. But Paul says that it has. And I think I know where truth lies, and I think I know where error lies within this point. In Colossians, the 2nd chapter, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. But one of the clearest passages of all is to be found in Hebrews 10 and verse 9. He taketh away the first, that he may establish the second. What is the first? The law of Moses. What is the second that was to be established? It's the law of Christ, the system of Christianity. The one has been taken away, the other has been removed. On the final point, I want to notice just a few things that I believe will serve to conclude our study today. In the first place, Many people will say we're under the Old Testament law. But when we call their attention to the fact, that means that you're obligated to observe the Sabbath day. Now sometimes they'll shy away and say, well, I don't think we have to observe the seventh day. I think that we ought to observe Sunday, the Christian Sabbath. But if the Ten Commandment law is still here, that means the Sabbath day law is still binding and we're obligated to keep it. Not only that, but sometimes, and I've run into this quite often in Bible studies with people, when I've explained the difference between the law of Moses and the law of Christ and suggested that the Old Testament law, all of it, has been removed and that we're now under Christ and Christianity, sometimes people will respond by saying, oh, then you're saying that we can worship any God that we want to? That we can make for ourselves an image or a likeness of something in heaven, upon the earth, or underneath the water? That we're free to take the name of the Lord, our God, in vain? That we can dishonor parents? That we can murder at will? That we can commit immorality at will? That we can steal? That we can lie? That we can covet as much as our heart desires? Evidently, these people have never realized that Moses is not the only moral regulator in the Bible. In fact, these nine have been part and parcel of dispensation of the patriarchal dispensation of the Mosaic economy and of Christianity. And evidently, they feel like Jesus Christ could not be a regulator. He could not be a teacher. He could not be one that demanded morality, ethics, and the like. Well, he has taught us what our moral law is. Now, sometimes, and I think we probably ought to think this thing through a little bit more. Sometimes we'll say, well, nine of the ten have been brought over and made a part of Christianity. Well, does that mean that all of the penalties for the nine, when violated, have also been brought over and made part and parcel of Christianity? I think I can produce Old Testament proof to the extent that when every single one of these commandments, the Ten Commandments, was violated, it called for capital punishment. Now, do we have capital punishment resting upon every violator of these commandments today? And if so, who is to carry it out? Who is to execute it? We know who was authorized to carry it out under the Jewish dispensation, because they had religion and human government wrapped up into a theocracy. And hence there was a power to execute the idolater, the murderer, the adulterer, the thief, and the like. But who is in position to do that today? I think it's much safer to suggest that these great moral laws have been part and parcel of every dispensation in which God has dealt with a human family. And of course, we are obligated to keep them, not because they were part of patriarchal law or part of the Mosaic system, but because they are part and parcel of Christianity. We've been under, I think, three different constitutions here in Tennessee, if I remember my Tennessee history correctly. And there's things that we are obligated to keep under the third constitution that were also under the first and the second. But we keep them today because they are in our current Constitution. At one time, our country was under the Articles of Confederation. Now we're under the Constitution and have been since way back in the latter part of the 1700s. Some of the same things that are taught in our Constitution were also taught in the Articles of Confederation. Why do we keep them today as American citizens? Because the Articles of Confederation taught them in the 1780s, or because they were made part and parcel of the Constitution by James Madison, father of the Constitution, and others who worked with him? Well, obviously the latter. We keep them because they are part of our current Constitution. But the Ten Commandment law has been repealed. It has been annulled. It has been taken out of the way. And we're now under Christianity, now under the gospel of the Son of God. And it seems so distressing to me that we're going to have to even teach our own people the difference between the law of Moses and the law of Christ. We've been doing that with denominational people for a long time, And now some of our own preachers need to be taught the difference between what came by Moses and what came by Jesus Christ. Thank you.